Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And welcome to the end of July. This has been a really surreal July for me. This is probably the craziest month I've had maybe in my whole life. First, on the 4th of July, my band got to play the national anthem on television and in front of tens of thousands of people at Broncos Stadium. And that was nuts. Then I got to have a conversation with one of my comedy heroes, Greg Berendt. And that episode just dropped last week. And that was amazing. And then tonight I'm playing a sold out show opening for Candlebox at the Summit Music Hall here in Denver. Now, I've also had some other kind of personal things come up that have been life-changing and huge, but I'm not quite ready to talk about those yet. But it has been a really surreal and astonishing month. And what do you do when you have that many things happen all at once? It seems like all at once. I'll tell you what I did. My first thought was, what am I going to do to top this? You know, I suddenly wanted more. Just more of everything. Like, more amazing conversations. More amazing experiences. You know, on to the next one. What's the next thing? What's the next thing? But then you slow down a little bit. You have time to think about it. You have time to be, you know, more emotionally mature about all of those things. And you realize that it's not about topping the last thing you did. And it never should be. It should always be about being in whatever moment you're in and enjoying every aspect of it for what it is. And that's not to say you can't look back on something amazing and feel that it was amazing. That's wonderful. But you don't want to get stuck there, because then you'll stagnate and you'll never be looking at where you are and what you're doing. So that's something that I'm trying to do. It's not always easy, especially for me. Change is something that I don't tend to tackle very well up front. I always handle it well eventually. But my initial reaction against any change, positive or negative, is to fight. I don't know. It's something in my wiring I'm trying to fix. And, you know, I think stillness exercises and meditation are really, really helpful for me. And if you haven't tried that, I highly recommend it. Because if you're the kind of person that can't sit with yourself in silence for 5 minutes, oh, believe me, I live that existence, and I'm working on it. So hit me up. Let's talk. Speaking of talking, today on the show, we have got fellow musician and fellow deep thinker and just all-around great dude, Peter Higgins. Now, what you may not recognize while we're in the middle of this conversation is that Peter is someone who has had some pretty crippling social anxiety in his life. I also have struggled with social anxiety pretty heavily. And so the resulting conversation is two people who are not comfortable with people trying to have a conversation as if they're comfortable with people. And it actually works out pretty well. In fact, if I didn't tell you any of this, you probably wouldn't even know it. But why do I bring it up? I think I bring it up because you never really know what somebody is going through, what's going on in somebody's head and in somebody's heart when they're doing something that seems like it should be the easiest thing in the world, which is just having a conversation with somebody. It really shouldn't be that hard. And yet sometimes it's really difficult. It can feel like you're giving away the biggest secrets of the universe and that you could be attacked personally at any given moment. Just for saying the wrong thing. But we have a really good conversation here, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So, without further ado, I give you Peter Higgins. Good.
Good.
Okay. Awesome.
Cool.
Hi. How's
Hi.
It going?
Good.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So, you had a swim thing earlier today for your kid.
yeah. Well, I have twins actually.
Oh, wow.
14. So it's for both of them. Yeah. I mean, it's good that they're. I used to do it when I was their age, and
yeah,
you know, they've been doing it, so it's fun. The drawback is getting up at 6:30 on Saturday to go to a meet.
That's all right though. I mean, there's something kind of magical about you know, that 6 a.m. kind of hour in the morning.
Oh yeah,
like it's really good if you can do it.
Yeah,
but
I think I'm sort of a morning person once I'm up and I've had coffee.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like getting out of bed part.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But yeah, if I have an opportunity to get up early like that, I'm always, I think, generally in better spirits in the morning than other times of day.
Yeah, it's a real good time to just take a minute for yourself, have a cup of coffee,
mm-hmm.
get the day mentally prepared, and just get yourself set for where it is you need to be.
Yeah, I think so.
So, tell me this, where are you from originally?
I'm from Denver.
Right from Denver, huh?
Yes. You know, you don't meet many of us nowadays.
No, not really.
I mean, I've lived in and around Denver my whole life. I mean, there was a point where my wife and I were getting ready to move to San Diego. I had to transfer in with my job and all that, just to live by the beach for a while.
Yep.
But then, she got pregnant with twins.
Yeah.
Which was we were not really trying, but we were open to it and just sort of got sloppy. And then, and that's a mind fuck is having twins. I mean, I think everybody sort of thinks about having a baby at some point. Like, what would that be like? But never does it cross your mind that, like, what would it be like to have two babies?
Right.
So that's a lot to deal with, just that news. But then just the thinking of, you know, there we would be in a new city knowing nobody.
Right.
And
the
having
support
twins
structure's gone. Yeah, everything.
So we just canceled that and stayed. And
yeah.
Here
wow,
we are.
That's nuts. So with, I would have to imagine that, because when you're a regular parent, I say regular, but
you mean like having one kid.
Yeah, when you have the first kid and the kid comes out, you got one.
Uh-huh.
But then I know how stressful that can be. So I can't even imagine how stressful it is to have two immediately.
If we had nothing to compare it to is the
right.
thing.
Yeah, that's just your experience.
And a baby is going to blow your world up regardless.
Yeah.
So I don't mean, would it have been easier with one? Probably, but you know.
Well, just different, I guess.
Just different,
I mean, you find out what you're made of.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Kids test that in you anyway.
Right. I'm sure it would have been, I mean, easier in general, but either way, it's a challenge, and you're figuring it out as you go along.
What
you don't
you
know
like
what you're
as
doing.
A kid?
I mean, I was pretty reserved, easy kid. I mean, my mom and dad, I think, would consider me an easy kid. I didn't get into a ton of trouble, or I wasn't difficult. I was pretty like in my own world, sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know, go in my room by myself a lot and play with my toys or whatever.
Yeah.
I was which left them, I think, a little unprepared to deal with my brother, 6 years later, who was a little more harder to deal with, I guess. Yeah. So, I mean, and kids can really vary as far as what an easy child and a hard child. And,
for sure.
Both of ours are pretty easy to deal with, I think. When they're little, it's more about the manual labor of things and
absolutely.
You know, lack of sleep and the things you have to just do and the things that occupy your time. But you never question yourself as far as can I do this? You just sort of accept that it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah, but it is kind of a thing where you're sort of almost I was talking to another guy about this actually, mm-hmm. and he was saying that. You know, you give yourself over to the service of another human being.
Yeah.
And it is definitely like that.
Yeah,
you just go, well, okay.
Yeah.
Everything now sort of revolves around the unit rather than the individual.
Yeah. It's not about me anymore. It's the thought that was crossing my mind over and over again when they were young.
Yeah.
Which is scary because it's always been about you growing up, you know, how am I dealing with this life? You know, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're not the priority anymore. And so that makes it, but it also makes it easier in a way because sort of the weight is off.
Yeah.
Trying to just advance yourself in life. You're like, okay, now, you know, it's them, it's not me. And it, in a way, it makes goals sort of come into focus a little more as far as what, just how to make a better life.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is a deliberate kind of mindset.
Oh, it is.
That requires a level of personal dedication and focus. Is that something that you've always had, or did you have to develop that?
I mean, I've had dedication, I think, to things that I find important.
Yeah.
But I've found it hard to just bring about dedication to something that I don't care about.
Right.
I guess, you know, most people probably have that in common.
Yeah.
But, you know, so with kids, obviously you care about that, or, you know, most people would. And so that was easy to, you know, okay, I'm committed to this now.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily require, it doesn't require the same sort of dedication that something else would. You know, this is, because it is different. There's like an instant attachment mm-hmm. the moment the kid arrives.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, okay. We're just going to lop off the options.
Right.
That's where it is. And I think that happens for most people. Yeah. There are people, of course, who are terrified and they say, I'm going to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's an instinctual part of it.
Yeah.
That just takes over. But also the sort of logical human part of it that comes in, like, if I don't do my job here, then I'm messing up a life.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, you know, you're always going to do something.
Yeah.
You know, and you never know what the thing is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, I mean, if you think about your parents and the way they managed things, uh-huh. I'm sure they managed everything just fine, but there's these one or two things, you know, that everybody has that they can point at and go, oh yeah, that's a dropped ball.
Yeah, well, that's what I was leading to earlier is when you get the manual labor part when they're young, but then as they get older, you begin getting into the realm of questioning whether you're providing what they need.
Yeah,
when they're little, it's just, you know, shelter, food, love.
Yeah,
that's it.
It's pretty easy.
It's a lot of work, but you know you have to do.
But it's you're right. It's manual labor.
Yeah.
If you can just handle the manual labor of it,
you
don't have to think about it much.
Right. Right.
You keep them alive.
Right. Yeah. Show them some love.
Yeah.
You know, make sure they're okay. As they get older, and you start to question, am I doing this enough? Am I doing that enough? Am I providing what they need? And then is when it really gets harder, and you start to.
Well, because then they're little people, and you have to have conversations.
Yeah.
And conversations can be hard.
Right.
Especially, you know, you're thinking, oh, where's the line for how I explain this?
Mm-hmm.
So what do I do with this? But in coming up the way that you did, when did you discover music?
I was a pretty late bloomer to rock music. I mean, I spent a long time just listening to whatever was on the radio.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, I say listening as if I was a fan, but I wasn't really even, I wouldn't have considered myself a music fan, per se. It was just, what was on the radio.
People listen to music, and so I listen to music.
Right, right. Yeah. And so for me, it wasn't until the whole 90s Nirvana, Pearl Jam thing where I really started getting into rock music.
Right.
And that was, so that for me, that would have been between my freshman and sophomore year of high school.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was right in my heyday, all that
right
stuff.
Right in the sweet spot, right there.
But interestingly enough, I was just actually talking about this with a friend the other day, that my first, like, what first drew me into it, I went to a camp, and there was a kid there who had an acoustic guitar somehow, which I don't, I always think, like, how did he get it, why did he have an acoustic guitar, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Did he bring it? he knew how to play Mr. Brownstone by Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
And it was like the hit of camp. And right. Like, everybody's asking him to play it over and over again, and he played it, and he played it, and he played it. And I thought that was just awesome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I had never heard the original song, but just him playing the song Mr. Brownstone. And then on the way home on the bus, he let me listen to Appetite for Destruction on his little Walkman.
Right.
And I had heard, you know, music like that before, but I'd always just not paid attention to it. Like, this is noise. But, you know, I wasn't in the right headspace to appreciate it.
Sure.
So then after having heard him play this song a million times, hearing the original version of it, and then listening to the rest of that album, that I remember that bus ride specifically, where, like, wow. And, like, going through the mountains, I remember what I was looking at out the window as I'm, like, hearing this and, like, really experiencing rock music for the first time.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, Appetite for Destruction was a pretty good record, especially for that. I mean, it's like, you can set aside all your feelings about X-Files and all of that and listen to that record, and it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the production on it and the writing and the mixing, everything on it is just, it's such a great rock and roll record.
It is, absolutely.
It totally encapsulates that that scary Los Angeles underground, dirty, like, when you listen to it, you're like, oh, this isn't safe.
Yeah. It's one of those albums that I find, listening to it as I'm older, that if you, I can hardly make it through the whole album. Like, you know, I'll be like, okay, I gotta turn this off.
This is too much.
This is an assault on my ears.
This seems irresponsible.
But then, actually, I didn't, you know, when I got home from that, I didn't wind up, you know, running out and getting that album for myself. It was like a week or so later, I went to visit a friend who had moved out to Connecticut. I went out there to go to his house for a week and hang out, and he was really getting into all the Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and that was all coming out at that time.
Yeah,
and so he
kind of hit it once.
Yeah, yeah. So he started, like, really exposing me to that, and then so by the time I got back, and was headed back to school, I was like Mr. Rock and Roll. Yeah. I mean, that was the summer that sort of changed me. And then, you know, by the end, I had been, you know, always playing drums and concert bands sort of thing, but I never had had a drum set. And then by the end of my sophomore year of high school, you know, I'm looking into getting a drum set and, like, let's start a band. You know, well, who's going to play drums? Well, I can do it. I'm pretty sure I can do it. And then, the rest from there is just sort of history evolving from, you know, one project to the next. So I was, over the course of high school, played drums in two different bands. And then, you know, just bouncing around from band to band ever since.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as it goes.
Yeah, that's that was really important for me. When I discovered music and joining bands.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my situation with that might have even been a little unusual for a lot of people. But that's actually what led me to both, A, discover that I had social anxiety.
Yeah.
And, B, discover that I could get rid of it by being a part of the show.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a lot easier when you show up to play a gig.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're there for work. You know,
like,
you're like everybody else. It's like, well, I have a reason to be here. I can justify my existence.
right. I'm supposed to be here.
I'm supposed to be here. And you can feel that. And that's something that's carried over to this day. Like, I got to do something really amazing on Thursday. On
the 4th
of July.
National Anthem?
Yeah, I got to do the national anthem at the stadium.
That's cool,
That was mind-blowing.
I bet.
But it was definitely, I still had a thing where it was like, I'm supposed to be here. I'm here for work. I have a job.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
I could travel around the stadium and do that. And it was great. Like, I played the House of Blues once.
Uh-huh.
And they gave us passes where we could just go anywhere. And so I was like, I'm just going to walk around and see how far I can get. So it's like I got into the basement. There wasn't anything cool down there, but
yeah,
they let me go down there.
That's cool.
So, you know, I mean, it's kind of a neat thing. But, I mean, discovering that, what kind of effect did that have on you as a person?
It gave me an identity of who I am. And it's that's something that's definitely still a part of me. I had never really found anything. I used to swim, like I said. I was like good at that, but I didn't really love it. So I didn't feel like that was sort of my identity. But once I found rock music and being in bands, it was just sort of all of a sudden I wasn't as nervous in school. I sort of knew who I was. And it was just, you know, and that's continued on as I've gotten older, where in between bands, or looking for a band, when I don't have a band, I'm just miserable and feel lost and hopeless.
Right. Yeah. That was a hard thing for me to cope with.
Mm-hmm.
When I first moved here, I had been a musician my whole life.
Yeah.
And when I moved here, my drums were in storage for a year. And it was the longest I'd gone without playing the drums since I was, I think, 14. And so it was like, I don't know who I am anymore.
Right.
Because everything that I had, everything that I had built myself around,
right,
including my personal relationships with other human beings,
yeah,
it was all music related. And so once that was gone, I was like, I don't know who I am anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a real identity crisis.
It is.
How do you manage that when you're going through parenting?
Because
I imagine it's got to affect the time that you're available, the scheduling that you're available.
Yeah, well, I mean, emotionally it makes it easier, I would say, because you still, like we talked about, have this other purpose.
Right.
So there's that.
So you can shift those gears.
So you don't feel completely, you know, worthless. I'm still doing something important,
right,
that I love doing. So that's all good. What makes it harder from just a practical standpoint is it's much easier to be in a band that's already working and doing stuff than it is to try and start something new.
Oh, that's fair. That's really fair. Yeah.
So, when I've been in a band, it's been fine because it's just practice. Shows it's on a schedule ish usually, and so it just works into life.
Yeah.
But when you're trying to start something up, and you know, find other musicians, I mean, that's hard to juggle with family for sure.
Right.
And so I mean, since I started playing drums, the longest period of my life that I went without being in a band was right after the kids were born for, 3 years or so.
Yeah.
Actually, my band, just by coincidence, the last band I was in played, I think, one more show after they were born.
Yeah.
And then that band broke up, and, you know, I wasn't in a place at that point then with newborn twins to be trying to get a new band started. I didn't really feel... I was your world gets so blown up by having kids anyway that I was not feeling that usual sort of identity crisis that I would with not having a band. Because I always, in the back of my mind, it was like, okay, I'm just doing this now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get back to the music when my life allows me to.
Yeah.
And so I dealt with it that way. If I had been in a band that was still actively going at that point, I wouldn't have quit just because of the kids.
Right. You'd find a way to make that work.
I'd find a way to make it work.
Because, I mean, just through the conversation that we've had here so far, there are all of these things that you've said that make it seem like you're a person who is always kind of been good at compartmentalizing and self-discipline and moving yourself in the direction that you needed to move because that's what needed to happen.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
I think so. If you ask my wife, she'd say for sure. That's what's gotten me through, I think, almost everything in life is just being very good at compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
And this is that, and this, not letting this affect that. And So I guess I don't sort of in general think of myself that way from an emotional standpoint, but right. when I look at what I do and how I do things, I am very sort of disciplined and rigorous about things.
Right.
But I find it easier to get through life that way. I mean, if I just leave myself to my whim of, yeah. I don't feel like that doing that, and I don't want to do that, then I just do nothing.
But where does that come from? I mean, is that a reaction to something, or is that more of something that was kind of
I think
drilled into
I might have said that it was a reaction to just my... But I think that a lot less now, because my daughter is the same way.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we have been regimented with her at all. I mean, if you really... Having kids also shows you, you know, what... about your personality has come from genes.
Yes.
As opposed to how you were raised.
Completely.
And you're like, oh, that's me. That's what I do. Because yeah. she's the same way, very organized and compartmentalized. And, you know, if she has a plan to do something, she's going to go do it.
Right.
She's not going to flake out because that's just not who she is. She's very, you know, regimented, sort of like that. So I don't... and if I look at my parents and how I was raised, I mean, there was no, like, forcing me to be that way.
Right.
I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it typically things like that don't tend to come from, you know, like a direct, obvious push, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually some sort of, I mean, it can be reactionary, but a lot of times even that is sort of instinctual mm-hmm. based on the yeah. environment that you're in. So if you're in an environment that is requiring you
yeah.
to take care of yourself or motivate yourself because you're not getting motivation elsewhere, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Like sometimes it can be a reaction to something that's missing versus... you know, something that is being thrust upon you from an outside stimulus.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, perhaps it's my mom and dad. I was very lucky to have them. They've been great parents overall. But it was
yeah.
definitely not a very I don't want to say it wasn't loving, but there wasn't
right.
a lot of love shown. It
right.
was, you know, they're from like. Old New England sort of
yeah okay.
almost British
yeah
sort of so mentality about things
yeah
right there's not a lot of I love you said, not a lot of hugs, not a lot
right,
of kisses
right. yeah
and you know I don't really look back at my life thinking I wish I had more of that
right
because I mean I was, you know, it was fine
yeah
because that's who I grew up and it's fine
exactly and it wasn't awful
right
exactly
yeah
it was but it is one of those things that you look at as an adult and it's not really that you look at it and you go, well, that was fucked up. But you look at it as, well, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. That shaped me a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's one of those conscious things that as a parent, I've definitely been more, you know, more against, I've tried to do more of that for my kids.
Right.
More I love yous, more hugging, more.
Yeah.
Because it's been a conscious thing of, oh, you know, it might have been nice to have more of that.
Yeah.
In my life. So I'm going to give my kids more of that.
Sure. Yeah, there is always that thing within yourself when you're parenting.
Uh-huh.
Like, all right, how am I gonna do this?
Right.
You know, you have to really start thinking about what
there
your approach is going
to
be.
Yeah, and that comes after the manual labor part because you know that's just the doing.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to decide what sort of parent you're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's changed for me a couple of times.
Yeah.
I mean, I realized.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it's
the
an
ways
evolving
that
thing.
I was getting things wrong early on and. Going,
uh-huh.
All right, well, that's probably going to stick. You know,
the
therapist
right.
is going to hear
worst.
About this
yeah,
later.
Yeah, yeah.
But, it's...
Like, oh, my God, they're going to remember that.
Yeah. I'm going to course correct right now and figure that out. But it's, you know, it's an ongoing process. But it's an ongoing process that if you're a person who's kind of in touch with your own emotions
mm-hmm.
and your own dealing with yourself,
yeah.
that's a thing that... I feel like can make you a way better parent is if you have an understanding of yourself and the idea of when you can catch yourself making mistakes as a human
mm-hmm.
being and start self-correcting on your own.
Yeah.
And is that something that you've had a lot of experience with as far as like, because it doesn't sound like you've had a lot of, let's say challenges that you weren't able to put yourself in front of and on
yeah.
the other side of. Like there's an emotional intelligence to a lot of what you're saying.
Well, I think I always wonder, and I'm always wondering if there's how much denial I have about things that, because, you know, there are aspects of what I do and, you know, my life and the way things have come up where I'm more than willing to acknowledge those. But there's also like, what am I missing? Like, what am I not acknowledging?
Right.
Because another thing I know about myself is sort of a refusal to immediately accept criticism as a welcome thing.
Yeah.
My first reaction to criticism, even if it's constructive, is sort of like, wait a second. Like, no, I'm better than that.
Yeah.
And so I know, and that's working in, you know, things at work or on creative projects. That's sort of how I initially react to things.
Yeah.
And so I think there's probably a bit of that in my just emotional life as well.
Yeah.
And
is there like a streak of perfectionism?
Yeah. But I've, yes, there for sure there is. But I've also learned, I think, to sort of embrace that perfectionism is impossible.
Yeah.
And just embrace the chaos of, like, chaos is perfectionism.
Yeah.
One example of that is that when I was middle school, early high school, I was so particular about my hair.
Yeah.
Like, I had to be, like, perfect, the perfect part and everything. But then at some point, I just realized, I mean, and that sort of came along with getting into, you know, grunge music and that whole scene where, like, you know, like, don't, it's okay if it's messed up. Like, it being messed up and nobody cares. And, like, that is perfection, not the actual hair, every hair in the right place is perfection.
Right. Yeah.
So don't worry about it. And there's been a lot, I mean, that's sort of a metaphor for a lot of things that have changed as I've gotten older. I think.
Well, like what?
I mean, in general, just not being, having the goal of whatever it is not to be, you know, the absolute perfection.
Right.
But being okay with good enough, or like, that's my personal perfection.
Yes. Yeah.
And looking at perfection more as my own perfection rather than like perfection as the ideal in society of,
sure,
is this perfect?
Yeah. I mean, perfect is the enemy of good.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a tough thing to wrap your head around when you're so particular about things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a control issues at all?
I think so.
Yeah.
A lot of times
those things go together.
Right. That's one thing that's hard for me to recognize as compared to a lot of other issues I have.
Well, because you don't know you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't always recognize when you're trying to control a situation, mm-hmm, versus process a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because the two things can be very, very close to each other,
mm-hmm,
like right on the razor's edge.
Yeah.
And just thinking about how you're going to process a situation or make a situation work the way that is beneficial for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a control person, you're going to want to fix it.
Yeah.
If there's an issue, let's fix it. Anything that you perceive. But, you know.
I mean, a lot of that for me is whether I feel like I've been assigned control of whatever it is, because I'm perfectly willing to let situations just fall as they may if I feel like, you know, not my problem.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
my circus, not my monkeys.
I for sure don't feel like I have to control everything.
Yeah.
So it's like, is this my responsibility?
Yeah.
Or do I want it to be my responsibility? And if I don't, and I'm okay, which is, as a drummer in bands, that's, you know, drummers don't always have a lot of control over the big stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you're just sort of there doing your drums.
Right.
And in most bands I've been in on drums, that's been sort of, you know, I do my drum part thing, but I'm not too concerned with the overall control of the band or the music.
I'll suggest ideas. Freeing.
It can be freeing.
You're
the
person who just has to show up and, you know, hold the heartbeat steady.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good feeling.
It is a good
to
feeling.
To be able to come in and just your very presence makes it better.
Right.
You know, that's
knowing that the band, you know, they don't even want to practice without you.
Right. Yeah.
It is. And though feeling, what was I going to say? I mean, they I also feel as though the guitar, because I mean, in this new band that I'm getting into, I'm going back to guitar.
Yeah.
Which I haven't done since, you know, I'm 19 years now since last time I played guitar.
Oh, wow.
And sang in a band. And that was, so it's, you know, I've been in this zone of just being the drummer for a while. Because it was mainly because it was always easier to find a band on drums.
Always looking for drummers.
Anything else. And so it's been an interesting transition now. I mean, we haven't even played a show yet, but to sort of be the person in control of everything.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think I've learned a lot from just being the drummer for so long.
Yeah.
About letting some things go and not being so particular about you know, every little nuance of everything.
Yeah.
Though that is still hard when it comes to the drums.
Right.
Because I still think of everything musically, you know, around the drums.
Right. Yeah. Where's the backbone of this coming from?
Right, right.
I tend to write songs like a drummer. That's what people tell me.
Yeah.
Like your song sounds like the drummer wrote it.
Oh, I get that all the time.
Yeah.
anybody who began with drums, I think that's just sort of the way your musical mind has evolved.
Yeah.
And that's what you do.
So you started out with the drums and you were able to pick up other instruments and stuff.
Yeah, well, what I mean, well, I went to college and was in a dorm room where I couldn't have my drums.
Right.
So that was the impetus for moving the guitar. I had borrowed an acoustic guitar from a friend.
Yeah.
And just began, you know, learning chords and playing guitar because that was the only musical outlet I had.
Right.
At the time.
Yeah.
And so that was, but I didn't, and it was a while later still before I actually was ready to be in a band playing guitar. Mm-hmm. I got into writing pretty quickly, though.
Yeah.
And the motivation for me wanting to, initially 19 years ago, get a band going on guitar was, you know, I'd like to play my songs that I've written.
Right.
And as a drummer, you know, you can sort of get that in there into the band, but it's not the same. I mean, I don't like to sing and drum at the same time, so I never had interest in being singer and drummer.
Right.
Or
I did that a couple of times, and it's more trouble than it's worth.
Right. Yeah. It makes both things less enjoyable.
Yeah, because they both suffer a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really hard to get your breath control to the point where you can, you know, sing, especially if you're doing anything, you know, really rocking.
Yeah.
You know, you've really got to have yourself in check.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of work. It's too much work.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've never been much interested. I mean, I'll do backup vocals, but
totally.
That's about it.
Yeah.
And then the other option, of course, you could write songs and try and have the other guitar player, singer do it. But that's just not, you know. I'd rather just be. I'm into the person who wrote the song singing the song.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it should be that way. So
right.
So that band. I mean, we were called Right on Red. We played a few shows. We played at like, what was the name of High Dive before it was High Dive? Seven South.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we were okay. And then, but after, because of folks moving away, that broke up and it was like right back to drums for me.
Yeah. But putting your songs together, what do you typically write about? Do you take things from personal experience or are you working out like...
Well, I write better about things that make me sad or angry or lovesick or that right. sort of stuff. I don't write happy songs well.
Right. I don't either.
I mean, you can sit down with the idea of writing a happy song, and I have, but it never comes out quite right.
How do you feel about that? What do you think that is? Is it like an exorcism? Of something like, you know, getting something out or working through it, or
it's working through it. It's getting, you know, it's saying. I mean, sometimes, particularly if it's a song addressed towards a relationship, be it romantic or whatever. There's this sort of like, I hope you hear this someday, you know, because this is how I really feel.
Right.
So here, take that.
Yeah.
But there's also, you know, it can be about bigger picture things, and you just want to like say something you have on your mind.
Yeah.
And usually it's something that comes for anger, frustration, or that sort of thing. Or it can. I mean, there are times when it's not. It can be sort of. Emotionally neutral, just thinking about something.
Yeah.
You know, turning it over in your mind.
Sure.
Sort of lyrics. Not as if it's particularly positive or negative. I mean, I can get into that zone sometimes, too.
Yeah. But it is almost easier to let the music help you express an idea.
Yeah.
That's difficult to get out otherwise.
Yeah. It's, I mean, one of my motivations for moving back to guitar is they wanted to get back into writing more. I mean, that's the other thing that's suffering playing drums so much. I mean, I've put all my musical energy into playing drums, and I miss writing songs as much as I used to.
Right.
And if it is for sure true, if there's not an outlet for the songs, it sort of stems the flow of where they come from, at least for me.
Right.
Like if I'm actively recording or have a band, that's just playing songs that I wrote, then, you know, they tend to keep coming. But if they're not going anywhere,
yeah,
it just becomes this reservoir of old songs.
I find it's best to get those things out and do something with them as they strike you,
mm-hmm.
because even if they are embarrassing later, it exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place in time. It marks it. And I find that because I've got hundreds of old songs that mm-hmm. I never recorded.
Yeah.
And I look at them now and I go, yeah, I can't use this.
I did a few years ago. When I was trying to make myself get back into writing, I decided to do a project. And I chose February because it's the shortest month of the year,
yep.
where I would write a song and record it every day of the month.
Yeah.
And it didn't, I only got to like the 11th or 12th of the month because I was up until like 3 or 4 in the morning. Like, I got to get this recorded. This is my song for the day. And then I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
But what was great about it was there were ideas that I definitely would have abandoned.
Yeah.
If I hadn't been forcing myself to do this every day thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of those ideas turned out to be pretty decent.
Yeah.
And so that definitely opened something up as far as, wow, I shouldn't, you know, there are things, just because you don't love something right away doesn't mean that it's
But that's suck. That discipline again.
Yeah.
I mean, coming back to
I guess that, so. Well, you're right.
That personality thing that you've got, the discipline to push yourself through for in service of a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, that's something that's difficult for a lot of people to understand. But how, you know, you've got the ability to tackle tasks and move yourself forward. How are you with other things in your life? Like, are you just as good at maintaining relationships and friendships and things like that?
Well, I mean, my wife and I first started going out in high school, so we've maintained that relationship for a little while. I mean, there have been some on and off stuff, but for the most part,
sure.
we've been together since then.
You gotta have a little drama.
So I've been good at maintaining that relationship. As far as in general, I mean, I've always been the sort of a few close friends, not a ton of friends.
Yeah,
and those who I really care about, I'm good, but about staying in contact with, but also always feeling guilty about not reaching out to them enough.
Right. Yeah. But that can be a tough thing. I mean, are you generally pretty introverted or?
Yeah, generally.
Yeah.
And, you know, but most of my close friends understand that.
Sure.
So it's not as if I have to, prove to them anything. I try to. I guess, there are, I mean, I would be lying if I said there were relationships that I didn't, regret losing because I didn't put enough work into it.
Sure. Yeah.
And I for sure have that side of just wanting to, not go hang out with people and not do things. And, that sort of mindset definitely makes relationships suffer sometimes when you don't want them to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's something that, just about everybody struggles with, especially as you age and you start moving into, your adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those things tend to get harder and harder to maintain organically.
Yeah, you really have to force yourself.
Yeah, yeah, you have to put in some work to make it all happen. And especially when you've got a unit like a wife and kids.
Yeah,
There's a group of you now
where
you have to make the decision, this one's going to go and do this and this one's going to do this. And when do we get together? When is our time? When is this time? And learning to compartmentalize and separate all of those things so that you can all be yourselves while you're also part of the you know, this symbiotic.
For sure. I mean, one thing that I learned as a parent was I always, before having kids, felt I was good at pleasing everybody.
Yeah.
And I always was a pleaser.
Yeah.
And making people happy. I didn't want anybody to be upset with me.
Yeah.
But as you have kids and all of a sudden your time is... it becomes so much more hard to divvy up.
Yeah.
It was a long process of learning that it's like choosing who you want to be pissed off at.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, there's whatever the situation is, you're not going to, you know, somebody's going to be upset because you didn't go do this or you didn't
sure.
do that. And who do you want to be upset with you? And usually it's not going to be your kids.
Yeah.
Or your family.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, therefore, you just have to accept that there's going to be other people.
Yeah.
And since we had the twins relatively young, we were only 27.
Yeah.
And so the rest of our friends at that time, I mean, they weren't even close to being ready to have kids. And so, yeah. I mean, a lot of them just sort of dropped off the face of the earth at that point. Because, you know, as much we tried to sort of maintain relationship, but, you know, there was like, hey, we're headed out to whatever on Saturday night. Can you come? And like, no.
No.
No, we can't. We've been through this before.
You guys want to do lunch? I'm just waking up. That'll be breakfast.
Right. You know, and a lot of those friends, those important relationships from that time of, you know, we've reconnected with a lot of those folks as they've gotten older and they have young kids now.
Right.
And then there are others of those relationships just went away completely because, you know, they were more sort of drinking buddies anyway, it turns out. They weren't actually friends.
Once in a while, you'll make friendships that, you know, they're only in your life for as long as they're in your life.
Right.
I was thinking the other day how I was on a Greyhound to California. I found pictures the other day from when I was early 20s, going off to California, and there's pictures of some dude that I was friends with on the bus. I don't remember who he is.
Oh, really?
But we made friends on the bus.
Right.
He was a single-serving friend. And that's all
that
it
was my
to
best
it.
Buddy. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't remember his name. I remember what he looked like. I remember we had a good time, laughing about something.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to do? Yeah. Is if people come into your life and they come out of your life.
In the moment of those sorts of relationships, it can sort of feel like, man, I made a great friend today. We're going to be friends forever.
Exactly.
Right. And then here you are later. I don't even know who that guy
is. I don't know who this guy was. Yeah. I'm not sure who the fuck that guy was. You know, it, for all I know, he could be somebody awful now. Who knows?
Right. Who knows?
Yeah.
But he was nice to sit with on the Greyhound.
Exactly. Yeah. Completely. And so, you know, you have those friendships for the time that you had them, you know, and it was like, all right, it was what it was, and we can be happy about it and move on.
Yeah.
But the level of emotional intelligence that you seem to have about everything is pretty great. I mean, most people.
Oh, no. I do declare.
but it is. It really is a more rare thing. I mean, there are a lot of people that have a difficulty with kind of recognizing within themselves when you know something needs to change or behavior isn't working or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to have a pretty good handle on it in the same way that you have a handle on a lot of these other things. And that isn't to say that you know there's not. You know, tripping in different places, but it is good to know that when things go sideways, you can handle that.
But it does leave me always sort of wondering how much of this is real. Like, do I really have this under the control, or is it just my like emotional or you know my intellect sort of keeping my emotions at bay by, you know, saying, no, you know, don't worry about this. It's this and this and this.
Yeah.
Everything's cool.
But see, what that is that's the control piece again. You know, just wanting to make sure that you've got everything under control and wondering how much of it really is and how much of it is you in denial.
Yeah.
But that's a thing that's pretty typical of control people. The very fact that you're concerned about it and aware of it as something to be looked at and monitored is correct. It is a thing to be looked at and monitored. It's a lot harder
When you aren't aware.
When you're not aware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you're a person who's kind of vigilant mm-hmm. of the fact that, you know, oh, I got some darkness creeping yeah. in, I got to do something about that.
My mom is a therapist.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, just you, like, running through all that sort of makes me think. I mean, all of that stuff was openly talked about growing up because she used to – I mean, she was – I think she was sort of a compartmentalist, like – she is, like I am.
Sure.
But, you know, if there were interesting things from work or interesting elements of, you know, human psyche, be it hers or anybody else in the family, she loved to talk about that stuff. So growing up, it was always open.
Yeah.
And, you know, like mental state and how it relates to emotion. I mean, it was always talked about.
Yeah.
As just normal.
See, now that is very atypical. Because that's not something that most people do talk about as they're growing up. That's the family secret shit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my wife grew up in a family where therapy was thought of, you know, you only go to therapy if something's wrong with you. Like, why would you do that? So that's how she grew up. And so she's still hanging on to that. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, for me, I'm the other end of it. Yeah. You know, like, no, it's just like, you know, if you have... you hurt yourself, you go to the doctor.
Right.
It's just normal. And she's like, I guess so. And I'm like, no. So, yeah. I mean, we have, you know, I don't mean to get, we've had many, many arguments and conversations that have revolved around that.
Sure.
Which has been interesting.
Yeah. Well, my wife is a scientist. Uh-huh. And so, you know, her brain works like a scientist. But as such, emotional things are confusing to her. Uh-huh. She doesn't understand, you know, why you can't just shut that off, or you know, well, just don't feel that way. It's irrational.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah. that's emotions. You're welcome.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit like that. I definitely, but you know, acknowledge. I also acknowledge. Okay, this is an emotion that.
Yeah.
There's no reason for me to be feeling this way right now, but I do.
Yeah. Exactly. But that's a recognition point, and that's a healthy recognition point. It's something that, like, I'm bipolar.
Yeah.
And so for me, I had to come to terms with the idea that there are going to be times when I'm feeling emotions that are coming from chemicals, not stimulus.
Right.
And so the idea was, you know, how do I trust what I'm feeling in the moment? And you kind of just have to eyeball it.
I think that's a place where everybody sort of should at least try to get to far as, you know, acknowledging.
I don't think you have to be bipolar
to
question how you're feeling about something.
Just acknowledge that there will be emotions that, you know, there's every reason, you might have every reason to be in the best mood.
Right.
You know, like you're going on a vacation tomorrow and all these great things are happening, but you're not.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, you know, sometimes it's just going to be that way.
Yeah. And again, that's the discipline of going, well, I'm not going to let this fuck everything up.
Yeah.
This is what's happening, and let's make peace with it. Mm-hmm. So you had conversations about mental health awareness and whatnot growing up?
Well, I mean, she didn't frame it that way.
Right.
But it was just always sort of talked about. I mean, she would, you know, if she had...
Paint the fence.
If she had interesting patients, she would talk about that, which, you know, she wasn't supposed to, but, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But she wouldn't bring up names or anything.
Right.
Just, yeah,
but I mean, she wasn't coming home and saying, oh, this nut job.
Yeah.
Like,
well, there's a little bit of that.
I'm sure there was.
Yeah. I mean, just because she's a therapist doesn't mean...
Well, sure, but I have to believe that there's some sympathy in some places.
Oh, it's always sympathy. One thing I got from her for sure is, like, oodles of empathy for everybody going through everything.
Yeah.
And understanding that, you know, there's not... A lot of problems that people have are not their fault.
Yeah.
You know, they're going through some shit that, you know, it would be irresponsible for me to assume that I know what that's like.
Right, yeah.
And to just be open to, you know, whatever problems other people may have.
Yeah.
And for me, I mean, it makes me, I ask myself sometimes, is that naive to sort of be that way? I mean, it's a sort of overall view that there's not much, like, pure evil in the world. It's all, you know, everybody is dealing with their life the way they
deal
with it.
There's not a lot of danger in being overly empathetic. The thing that you've got to be vigilant with when it comes to being empathic towards other people, mm-hmm. is that you don't let it infect you in a negative way.
Yeah, because, yeah. Well, that's a different...
Because
yeah.
you will feel kind of the... You will feel the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
You'll notice it. If yeah. somebody's having a bad time,
yeah,
you know, you can be susceptible to recognizing that bad time is there. And if you've got the control thing too,
right.
you can want to fix it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And well, what's the... I'm drawing a blank here. The empathy is more feeling what the other people feel.
Yes.
And then what's the term for when you're... you don't necessarily feel it, but you recognize...
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Because that is empathy as well, but it's more of a I don't know.
It's what is a term for it? But it is exactly. But it is more recognition. I mean, I feel it in the way that like somebody who's down or angry can bring down a room.
Sure,
but it doesn't. I don't really absorb feelings. It's more yes. just recognition that
right.
That person is that way at the moment.
Yeah. But, I mean, you've also had a long history of learning to keep yourself...
I mean, that was my mom's job, and she always talked about it, so I guess I just absorbed a lot of those traits.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you wouldn't want a therapist who is overly empathetic as far as feeling your emotions also, or it could be a mess.
Yeah, exactly.
They just want to be able to acknowledge it.
Yeah, because then, I mean, what are they going to do when they get home at the end of the day?
Right, right.
Just drinking.
Right, well, they have to compartmentalize.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, this gives me a box to put it in.
Right, right.
So you've gone through all of these things. You use your music and it sounds like your mom was pretty helpful in teaching you an emotional intelligence. How do you manage things when, like, say the people in your life are having a problem with something
mm-hmm.
that they don't maybe have the same level of intelligence that you do? Or do you find that you're able to be more helpful in those kind of situations? Or do you kind of hang back?
I wish I could be more helpful. Sometimes there is a degree of, why don't you understand that, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
But you can't just talk people out of emotions usually.
Right.
And that's the part of it that is more difficult for me is, using... I mean, the way my brain operates is great for my own well-being, managing things, but I don't transfer it to others that well. I mean, I can give, a sort of like pep talk, but that's never really received all that well.
Right, because for you, it's mostly intuitive.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to teach something that you just sort of do naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easier to teach things that you had to learn yourself and are aware of how you learned it.
Yeah.
Than something that you just sort of do. And so that's been a more difficult thing. When my wife is having issues, I always feel bad that I'm not quite as able to help as I would like to be.
Right.
Because the way that she experiences her problems is way different than the way I do.
Yeah.
And so there's this, it's hard to relate to what's going on there.
But there is a recognition that
there's
what
a recognition.
She's going through is different.
Oh, yeah.
And that's helpful as well.
It is, yeah.
So.
And there's been, as I've gotten older, there's been more of a recognition of, I don't know if I can help you, but I'm here for you if you need me.
Right.
Beyond that, I don't know what I can do.
But what more can you do?
Right.
I mean, as a human being, the best you can do is be available to recognize that when someone tells you they're going through something, just mm-hmm. believe them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm here for you. I recognize that you're going through this, and let me know what you need.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes that's the best thing you can do for someone. They don't need your advice. They don't need your help.
Right. And it's easy to misinterpret that, too. I mean, I've gotten better at that as I've gotten older.
Yeah.
But that somebody who's in need is not asking for advice. They're right. not asking for coaching.
Yeah.
They just want you to understand and be there.
Yeah. Sometimes they just need a little bit of help gaining that strength for them to be able to pull themselves out of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, that's a really important thing.
Yeah. And, you know, but it's one of the, it's also a hard thing to tell if you're doing it right or not.
Yeah.
am I being the person I need to be right now to help this person through what they're going through?
How do you handle failure in general?
Well, I mean, usually begins with, a little bit of anger and denial.
Yeah.
Like, no way. Like, screw you. That was fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my fault.
Right.
It's your fault. You didn't, you know, appreciate that as much as you should have. But I am such a logical person that eventually I sort of come around to the reality of what happened and sort of am able to step back and look at the big picture of things. And
yeah.
I mean, that takes – it's not – you know, I make it sound like that's easy. I mean, when it's a big failure, well,
no,
it's not
of course.
Something that's – it's not – you know, it takes time to – like, okay, this is what went wrong, or this is what I did that led to this.
Yeah.
But even then, it's amongst all the things that I am able to acknowledge about myself. I mean, one of the hardest things, and one of the things that I'm probably least likely to and most in denial about acknowledging is failure.
Yeah.
You know, if you ask me, like, what are the biggest failures in your life, those are things I sort of push to the bottom. And I'm sure they're there.
Yeah.
But, you know, my first inclination is, like, failures. That's a strong word. I don't know if I've ever failed at anything. I mean, I'm here.
Let's calm down.
Yeah,
failure's a tough one. It's a tough thing to make peace with. I mean, I think even when you have a healthy reaction to failure, mm-hmm. the healthiest it is just going, I boned that. How can I do better?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the idea. Even then, you're kind of controlling it. You're kind of putting it into a framework of,
yes.
Well, see, I learned something from
right,
it. So it's a learning experience.
Well, and also like, it happened because of this and this. And
yeah.
It wasn't my fault. It's not going to happen again.
It's simple math.
right.
Yeah.
But the compartmentalizing and over-logicing everything get to be too much sometimes.
Yeah.
And I do struggle sometimes with trying to get out of that part of it and just be more emotional about, what happened, why did this happen? And not from like a quantitative sort of perspective, but, you know, what was I feeling? What was I going through during that? Because you learn more looking at it that way, I think, than you do looking at the, A happened and then B happened and then that led to failure.
Right. But there is a balancing act between the logic and the emotions.
Oh, yeah.
Because they, especially if you're a logical person, you can sometimes try to outthink your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And push them back, with logic. Like, well, logically, this is this and this is this, and you can even kind of get yourself to believe things.
Yeah.
That may or may not be the case mm-hmm. emotionally. You can be dismissive of certain emotions because they're not serving you the way that you'd
like. Well, and you can even like work yourself into a place that's not really logical to begin with. Overthinking things.
Yeah, exactly.
And winding up somewhere that's not, not the reality of the situation at all.
Yeah.
You've just sort of logicked yourself into
that. You've created a reality.
Right.
A version of the reality in your head that is not the reality of the world.
Right.
But how are you at recognizing, when you're doing that? Does that happen to you often or not very often?
I mean, I'm probably not very... just because that's so how I operate.
Yeah.
I don't take a lot of time to say, oh, this is what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
You know, as far as all these self-recognition things go, so recognizing that I'm over-logicking or overthinking something is probably not high on the list of things I recognize.
Sure.
Because it's just, you know, the way I operate.
Yeah.
You know?
But out of all of these things, I mean, there seems to be a level of emotional wisdom that is running through all of this. That's, you know, years and years of just sort of, you know, doing the work of trying to keep yourself on the rails, you know, like any other human being would.
Right.
You had this extra helping hand at the beginning of being taught on an intuitive level and emotional intelligence by your parents. You know, even if they were, you know, a bit withholding in that area, it seems like there was also an education happening in that area.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I never felt abandoned or sure. you know, left behind sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
You know, they were always there.
That balance of logic and love.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess that's, maybe that's who I am today.
Right. but it served you pretty well.
I think so. I mean, you know, it's sort of, I think, hampered my ambition a bit. Like I don't
because you're comfortable.
Maybe I mean I do feel like you know I'm too comfortable in things like
yeah.
And sort of you know just managing like you say managing my day to day ride.
Yeah,
I don't. It sort of takes me out of looking very far ahead and like really, like long term goals and that
right.
sort of thing. I'm very just like okay, this you know we're just managing this as we go. Here we go.
Yeah,
And not it's never. There's never, like, probably part of the reason I look and it's hard for me to pinpoint big failures in my life.
Sure.
Is because I've, you know, I've managed everything so that failures haven't seemed that big in the moment.
Right.
And so I've never
so
had that,
like. So
it's
more of a hindsight missed opportunity.
Right. So I've never been, like, you know, knocked down, bottom out, like, oh, now I'm. I don't have that sort of driving motivation.
Right.
That comes from something like that for most people.
Right.
To then, you know. Go to great heights.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but that's, so, I mean, whether that's a sort of an idea, I guess. I don't know. I've never, that's a part of, and I've, it's really not anything I've attributed to the way I was raised before as far
sure.
as my, like, lack of, you know, ambition. What, I mean, what is ambition anyway? I don't even,
yeah.
you know, I, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing is sort of an odd concept to me. Like,
ambitions are just a series of wants.
Yeah,
that's all it is. It's your willingness to do the work to get the things that you want. And if you don't want something that's you know overly gigantic,
right.
then you can appear unambitious.
True. I mean, there's
but what do you want? What makes you happy?
I mean, just choosing. For me, it's always been so mostly about choosing to be. Happy in the moment and
yeah.
with the immediate
yeah.
rather than having some big goal that I'm going to sacrifice a lot of things to get.
Right.
That's never been the part of, I guess, controlling the immediate is
yeah.
not looking far beyond that.
But there's nothing wrong with living in the now.
Yeah. I don't know. I used to feel more guilty about that sort of thing, but
yeah.
now, I mean, I don't, you know. As it relates to music per se, I mean, when I was in my 20s, it was all about, you know, I wanted to be in that band that made it big and
oh, yeah.
that's what I wanted to do with my life. Like a lot of musicians.
Sure.
And so a lot of stuff musically that feels like failure.
Yeah.
When you're that age and you're not doing what you want to do. But as you get older and you know, you're over 40 and still playing in a band,
right.
it gives you that perspective of why you're actually doing it.
Right, exactly.
That's
because your motivations change and your expectations change.
Mm-hmm. And it makes it more fun,
yeah.
I think.
Absolutely.
Because you're not, you know, you don't have that, there's not that pressure of, you know, trying to make it, trying to be this huge band or anything like that. It's just about going out and doing it because you love it.
Yeah, and enjoying things as they come.
Right.
You know, playing a gig for the sake of playing a gig.
Right.
Because it feels great.
Right.
And do you have recordings of the old stuff?
Well, I mean, I've recorded most of the bands I've been in have recorded. You mean from way back?
Yeah. Like, do you have those things that you can look back at and say, yeah, here it is? Like,
yeah. Well, actually, one between bands a few years ago, the recordings for this new band are based off an EP that I recorded by myself. Which is something that I had always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I found myself between bands and actually out of work for a little while, so it was sort of like, oh, this is my opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it just went in and recorded. You know, I did drums, guitars. I had a friend record bass on a few songs, but other than that, I just did the whole thing myself.
Yeah.
And that really was like a bucket list item checked off that I'd always wanted to do.
Right.
And so those, some of those songs were songs from the old band Right on Red. And then there were some newer songs on there as well. But that's always a moment of those things. I mean, I'm really proud of the way that turned out. And it's always like a feather in the cap where if I am feeling at all worthless about my life and what I've accomplished, it always, can turn things up a notch, make me feel a little happier to go back and listen to that old stuff. And like, I did that.
Well, and that's kind of the point. To be able to... to be able to quantify it in that realm, to be able to look at those past things, if you've got some sort of a representation of that, that's what I think those old recordings are really good for, is to be able to say, here's a thing that exists in the world that didn't exist before, and I was a part of this. This is a moment in time, and you can hear it, you can listen to it, it exists, and it's a way to... I don't know. It's almost a legacy thing. Like this is the thing I'm putting into the world, and for better or for worse, this exists.
Right.
And how great is that? That this exists. That I can point at this and say, "Yeah, the sound quality on this is terrible. What was I thinking?" But here it is, and it.
I mean, that's the beauty of any art is creating something and having it be out there in the world
for sure. And the fact that it's, in its permanence, it's fully dating itself and making itself obsolete while making itself matter at the same time.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to look at state.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I always find that really fascinating. And I think that that's a really good way to look back at past projects versus just having those nostalgia goggles on.
Yeah.
Because nostalgia is going to kill you.
Right.
But if you can look at it in a healthy way and have an appreciation for the things that you've
done. I've always looked at old recordings as more of like going through an old photo book.
Yeah.
Which is nostalgia, but it's also, that's who I was then.
Right.
That's the way things existed at that time.
Yeah. But you got to be careful with nostalgia. Like nostalgia is a place to visit, not a place to live.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's really the key, because if you're living in the past, you're going
to
miss it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a lot of my motivation for wanting to get back to, getting my songs that I've written out there. I've had this creeping feeling of resting on my laurels of songs I've written in the past.
Yeah.
And, I just want to get back into a more active form rather than, this is how I used to be. Like, I used to write songs. I used to do all that stuff. Now I'm just a drummer for hire moving between bands and... So, I think that's probably part of it, wanting to leave more of a legacy.
Yeah.
Which it feels more like a legacy when it's songs you've written rather than just...
Yes. Just stuff you performed on.
Drums that you played, yeah.
Right, yeah. I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about... I've been starting to write again lately, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, putting things together. It's definitely a lot more satisfying when you can... when you can look at it, but there's also the hubris of knowing, or rather, you have to set the hubris aside and know when to bring in help. from the outside.
Yeah, for sure.
Like you said, you brought in a bass player. I brought a bass player in to do something. It's like, I probably could have played the bass, but
the motivation behind that was more like I just didn't, I don't really want to sit and figure out bass parts. I'll let somebody else do it.
Sure. But there's something satisfying about learning how to let go and collaborate, even if it's just a little bit. I mean, it's an important skill to learn as a human being.
Yeah.
But as a musician, it can be ultimately very rewarding to learn how to collaborate with other musicians because they will bring ideas that you weren't prepared for.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing always was when I played guitar in that band. I mean, we went through a few drummers because, as a drummer myself, I was pretty picky.
Yes.
And they're like, hey, they have to be at least as good as I am or I'm just going to be pissed off. Like, I could be doing this. B, you have ideas in your – head already preconceived about what you want the drum parts to be,
yep.
and you're less open to them changing that up than you would be some other instrument. So
yeah, that's totally.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, which is, so the drummer in this new project is my 14-year-old son.
Nice.
And that sort of came into being because my last band broke up due to people moving again. And there, you know, there I was, you know, between bands again. And he's sort of reached the point in his drumming where, you know, this guy needs to be in a band.
Yeah.
And all his other friends who were musicians at school also play drums. So,
so that's not going anywhere.
Right, right. So, you know, it's like, well, that would be a little weird having him as my drummer, and perhaps problematic for certain shows and such, but you know, we both need each other in this moment. So
sure.
And it's weird. I mean, he plays the way I play.
Right.
I mean, he is the most, I mean, even, you know, they're even playing the songs that were recorded already, he's pretty good at, you know, replicating what I did, but playing songs that there's been no previously recorded drum part.
Right.
He just will sit down and play. I'm like, oh my God, like that's exactly what I would have played.
Nice.
Like you're perfect. I've been waiting for you. So it's been pretty good. I'm looking forward to, you know, getting out there and doing some shows.
Yeah.
With him. I mean, I'm a little worried about controlling his nerves at first, you know, because he's 14. He's never done this before.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Well, I mean, it's going to be a grand experiment one way
or
the other.
It is, yeah. And the other question, of course, how long is he going to want to be in a band with his dad?
Right.
Not the coolest thing in the world.
Eventually, the little bird will fly.
Yeah, that's good. That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it is good. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Well, thanks for having me in.
Would you believe that both of the people that you were just listening to have a crippling social anxiety? Maybe you would. You know, I don't know how I come off on these things ever, honestly. But you know who came off great? Peter Higgins! That was a great conversation, and I told you it would be, didn't I? If you want more Peter Higgins, and I know you do, check out his band Whiff, W-I-F-F, as a part of the Brews Beers Summer Music Series, Night 3. There will be links in the feed below. You can also check out coffeeoversuicide.com to get the feed for the show, and it will have those links embedded in it. As for me, I hope you came to the show tonight, and I hope it was awesome. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.